We're going to have a look at simulating much bigger networks of components now for the final section of the course, really. So this is a picture which is a little bit too small to read, and the reason I put that up is to show you what something in the real world where these applications are used might consist of. This is a water flow treatment system of some sort. We have pumps in green. We have blue boxes, which seem to do something or other. We have tanks, which integrate flows. And we have some other components in here. God knows what they all do. This was just Google Images, first one that came up. I stuck it in the slides. And it shows the complexity. This could be a scrubber for cleaning the air in a spacecraft, indeed for cleaning the wee-wee so you can drink it again, which is what happens. Who knows what it is? Let's look at some simpler ones. This one is here in Cambridge. This is a fluid flow computer. It was built in 1949. It's an analog computer. It's full of water or cranberry juice or something because it's sort of orange so you can see it. And there's various tanks and weirs and valves. And this one is designed, it's in the Department of Economics, to model the British economy. So George Osborne, when he's working out whether to put up VAT or not, that's one of the knobs he can adjust. And other things in here are the borrowing rate and the Federal Reserve and the British is called, and whether North Sea oil has run out and all that sort of thing. And then the fluids go up and down in here, and then some expert has to stare at it and work out whether this is a happy situation or whether we're going to have civil riots and the Labour Party will get back in. So the important thing here is that this is an analog simulator, but it's roughly the same sort of thing as we'll be simulating in all of our fluid flow simulations. So here's a reference one that we'll work through in this lecture. It's a little bit smaller on here, and also I have redrawn it slightly since I printed the lecture notes. You'll see that this pipe now goes down to the bottom of that tank rather than stopping in midair, because this is the problem I wanted to demonstrate to you. So water comes in here at the top. Somebody turns this control on or off to stimulate the system. This tank will go up and down at a rate proportional to its difference between inlet and outlet flow rates. Same for that one. All of these pipes have resistance, and I'm using some very simple hydraulic formulae here. If any of you know anything about hydraulics, or if George Stokes was here in the audience, he would probably have a fit at this. But we're using very simple approximation that the resistance of horizontal pipes is linear, with the flow rate is going to be inversely proportional to the length and proportional to the pressure difference at the start and end. And we're going to assume the same for the vertical pipes, but with a slightly less resistance, although in actual fact, vertical pipes are highly non-linear because for low rates, you can put virtually any amount into them and it'll just go straight down with gravity. And for high rates, they'll essentially be the same as horizontal pipes. So it's all a bit simplified if you're a hydraulic chemical engineer, but it'll serve us in this example. And so by putting that pipe to the bottom there, we're going to get some back pressure up that pipe as that fills, and also it's going to be possible for it to siphon out the drain here if this one were empty, and it would go around there. So anyway, that's our flow diagram. Now, how might we program this up to simulate it? Well, the state variables are going to be the fill depths in the two buckets, and we'll need some model of what's coming in at the top here. So we can do this by hand, and if we do, we'll get some code rather like this one here. So we've put in all of the physical parameters, the density of water, the length of the pipes, the areas of the buckets. We have a couple of variables for our depths in the two buckets. We have a variable for the current time. Then we have some code that simulates the turning on and off of the input tap. So this is some function generator. And if you read this carefully, you'll see that if the time is between 1 and 2, or 4 and 4 and a quarter, then the stimulus is 12.5, otherwise it's naught. So that's a couple of bursts of water being put into our system. And then we work out the resistances of all the pipes using the equations, which really are hopelessly over-approximated. But you could plug in here quite easily proper Navier-Stokes equations if you wanted to. And then we have a bit of stuff here, which is the main simulation model, and that's actually quite tricky to work out by hand. So what I want to do is show you a way of automating it. So flow zero is the stimulus. That's easy enough to get. Another one that's pretty easy to get is that flow three is flow five. I think, again, from the hard copy, I renumbered them slightly more sensibly on this slide. So that's labelled F4 possibly on yours, but that's F4 now. And so because of conservation of water, these two flows are going to be the same. But here we have a junction, and water is going to divide in some proportion at that junction. And the question is, what is the proportion? That's the hard bit to work out. And again, this comes down to solving simultaneous equations, because the higher this bucket is filled up in here, the less pressure there would be down here. And so the more of it would tend to go that way. And then, of course, the overall flow rate is going to be proportional to the pressure at the bottom of this bucket, and so on. So working through those equations for a complicated network is exceptionally tedious and error-prone. But I did it on Saturday, made an error. I did it on Sunday and got it right. And these are the equations if you work them through by hand. And so the flow rate of 4 is rather simple to get. That's the depth 2 divided by the pipe resistance 4. That's just going to flow out there rather straightforwardly. But once we have equations for the flow, then we can complete the iteration. We can update the state variables. Bucket 1 is going to change in depth by the difference of flow in and out divided by its bucket area multiplied by the time step. Same for bucket 2. We can print them out and we can check for bucket overflow, some limits here. So if we run that, what happens? Will it work? Yep. So there's some plotting going on as well. See, blue is bucket 1 water depth, red is bucket 2 water depth, and there's two impulses coming in from the stimulus function, and we're seeing some sort of nice exponential decay. Now is bucket 1 looks exponential, bucket 2 looks a bit exponential. They're not quite exponential because they're interacting with each other. So you can write a program like that by hand, but this is going to be hopeless for very large systems of equations. So we need a systematic approach for doing this. So let us develop a systematic approach. Let's move for the moment to electricity rather than water. So in this first example, I have resistors and a battery. That's all I have. And the resistors have all resistances on them. So the resistors have got names, like R6 is 40 ohms. And all the resistors have different values to help us easily track what's happening in this system. And also, I have labelled all the joints between components with a node number, node 3, node 2, node 1, node 5. And one of the nodes, node 4 here, is taken as a ground reference. Without loss of generality, we can consider that one to be at zero potential. Now, it turns out that batteries are pretty common things for us to think about, but the basic system of solving flow equations doesn't work very well with a constant potential generators. And so we have to convert that to a constant flow generator, which in electronics is a perfectly fine component, and in hydraulics It's a perfectly fine component. If we just turn on that input tap to a certain level, we'll get a constant flow there. And those of you who've done this in physics will know that any battery in series with a resistor can be replaced by a current generator in parallel with the resistor. The resistance value is the same, 10 ohms. And the current generator and the voltage generator are related by Thevenin or Norton's theorem, which is that these two are always equivalent, that a battery of certain voltage in series with a resistor R is the same as a current generator in parallel with a resistance R, where V equals IR relates the voltage in the current generator. And that has, if you look at it, exactly the same open circuit potential with no current flowing in the circuit. There will be no voltage drop across the resistor. The battery voltage will appear here. With no short circuit, nothing connected on here, all of the current will be going through the resistor, and so V will equal IR, and so on. So that is a little bit more electricity than I really want to go into in this course, but it's helpful for, well, we have to do it for the basic form of this general approach to solving flow circuits, because we can't support voltage generators in the basic form. There's an extended form which supports voltage generators, but I'm not going to go into that. So that's the transformation that's taken place here. The bit inside the box replaces those two. The rest is the same. And so now the problem is to find out how much current is flowing at each point and what the potential on each of the nodes are. And we can do it by hand, solving the equations in an ad hoc way, or we can try and do it some systematic way. Ohm's law, V equals IR, for this work is going to be better written as I equals V over R, or I equals G times V, where G is the reciprocal of resistance. So the resistance reciprocated is the conductance, and we're going to be dealing with conductance matrices. And that's helpful because, generally speaking, a network of components will have lots and lots of nodes and roughly the same number of components interconnecting the nodes. And so in matrix form, it's going to be a very sparse interconnection network. And we want to have, there'll be lots of points with infinite resistance between them because there's nothing joining up those points. So it's easier to work in terms of conductances and just put zeros in for the points where there are no conductors. So on that previous circuit, I've only got one screen in here, which is unfortunate because you can't easily put both up side by side. But if we look at the previous picture, these equations are readily determined just by looking at the circuit. So the very first one on here is I1 equals N1 over 60. And there's the 60 ohm resistor. And this is node 1. And the current in resistor 1 is given by the voltage divided by the resistance. And so for resistors to ground, we have this sort of I1, I2, I6 equation. And for the ones that go between two nodes, then they look like this. So I3, for instance, is node 1 minus node 2 over 20. So that's this one here, 20 ohms between node 1 and node 2. So it's rather simple to write down all of these equations which describe the current or flow in every branch. And then we can apply Kirchhoff's current law, which is nothing more than the conservation of flow law. So as I said, for the water, that we have conservation of water in our pipes, the water into a junction is equal to the water out of that junction. And the same for electrical currents or heat flows or any other type of flow we're considering. So we're going to write down the nodal equations for our system. We can ignore the ground node. And on this circuit, there are three nodes, node 1, node 2, and node 3. And the conservation of current law says that the flow in and out of such a node is zero, the sum of all the ins and outs. And that's what we've written down here. That's our current generator, which is generating some current, 3.3, and that's the node 1 equation, sums to 0, node 2 equation, sums to 0, node 3. So node 3 equation simply says I5 equals I6, which is rather obvious because the current goes through there, can only go down through there. And then, once we've got them in this form, we can pop them into a matrix like this, and we can find the voltages as a simultaneous solution of these matrices. So writing out these three equations in matrix form, putting the minus 3.3 over the other side, this is the potential or voltage on each of the nodes, and this is the conductance matrix. And also, I've substituted in the values for the currents from the previous slide. So if we do all of that, we end up with the following simultaneous equation. There are three unknown voltages and three equations, so it's going to work out nicely. And one thing that we should notice about this matrix is that it's intrinsically symmetric. So that's going to help us. We can use a class of simultaneous equation solvers which are optimized for symmetric matrices. And another thing is that it's positive definite, which I haven't gone into the details, but if we look carefully at this, we'll see that we're adding positive things along the leading diagonal, and we're putting negative things elsewhere, and that is going to make it positive definite without doubt. And that means that we can use Kolesky's technique on it as well, which is great. And one more thing to note on this is what I've underlined and put in blue, which is just for one of the particular components in here, the 50 ohm resistor. Let's find it on the circuit between node 2 and node 3. That appears on here four times, and that's very much a characteristic of resistors when or pipes when modeled in this sort of flow structure. The conductance of it, which is the reciprocal of its resistance, is added on positively at the two nodes on the leading diagonal, and it's added on negatively in the opposite corners. If we look at the 20 ohm resistor, it's exactly the same, positive here, negative there, and negative there. And so that's the general template, as we call it, of a conductor inserted in our flow diagram. Now, some of the resistors connect not to two nodes on here, but one of the nodes and the ground. For instance, a resistor 6 here is connected to node 3 and also to node 4, which we're not including because it's the ground. And so, which one was that I was talking about? R6, 40 ohms. And so the 40 on here appears just here in one place. So for a conductor that's connected to the ground, it only appears once in the conductance matrix at the node it's connected to on the leading diagonal, but its other terminal doesn't exist in this view, and hence there aren't three other places for it to pop in. So that's great. So now we can solve, using an optimized simultaneous solver, the circuit condition and get the flow at each point.